Welcome to the Angry Edmonds Podcast for March 19th, 2007, episode number 20. Welcome back, everyone, to the Angry Edmonds Podcast. In this podcast, we talk about IT at work, gadgets at home, and where we think information culture is headed. To add some extra angriness today, we have a special guest, Mr. Jeff Graham, who's joining us. Jeff, how are you doing today?
Real good. How are you?
Pretty good. As always, I am Ryan Necessary, and we have with us also...
Joe Bibby.
Hey, Joe. Today, we're going to cover some of the news of the week and hash out what is good and what is just completely wrong in the world. Starting off this week, Joe, what was up with Google?
So Google had an interesting story. You know, they have this moniker of "Do No Evil," and there's been some concerns with the, you know, they keep all this information about us forever, basically, in all their logs. And mm-hmm. if you use a lot of Google's products, you can feel, you kind of get to begin to feel like they really could, you know, figure out everything about you. So they went on the record this past week saying that they are going to start anonymizing those logs after 18 to 24 months, which is a nice step forward. And they really are trying to show that they are really have the users as their first priority. You know, they said unless, you know, they're legally required to do anything else, that's what their plan is. They have some other nice things that they've already added to allow you to anonymize yourself. Like in the Google Talk, you can go off the record, so it no longer records your your chats, which can come in handy at times. And then like the desktop software, you can pause and lock search so that, you know, when you're searching, it doesn't keep adding those searches to their records.
I kind of wish it did this by default.
Yeah.
I mean, why should I have to opt out?
Well, so their logs aren't going to be that way. The 18 to 24 month thing is going to be automatic. It's the other things that they've had for a little while, like the off the record, which actually it's not by default, because they want you to be able to search your chats, but then you can just, it's right there in the menu, you just click and go off the record. I've used it actually several times.
Did you just say search your chats?
Yeah, and believe it or not, I have actually searched my chats.
That's interesting.
But what? I'm, you know, can I'm you, a Google addict, so I confess it.
In the chats, these are the text chats, right?
Yeah, just text chats.
So if somebody posts a link or something, then you can go back and look for that link
mm-hmm. in your Yeah, chats. That's a big one, and like I had somebody who I was helping them set up something, and they chatted me their password, which is failure in the beginning, but I was able to go back and search and find that password again, so well, then excellent. I could steal their identity.
Always good to be able to do that.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm waiting for sometime in the future when some presidential candidate, you know, is about to be elected, and then someone digs these skeletons of his Google searches yeah. out of the closet of Jessica Alba, or he like Google search like how to kill my wife.
I would yeah. vote for the Jessica Alba guy, just to let you know.
Yeah. Hey, did you guys hear about that? That there was some lady like went into work and searched for how to kill someone. I heard this week. Oh, and then she got arrested because her husband showed up dead the next week.
Right. And the, yeah,
so and they used the search records to actually like take her in.
Yeah, so Google, please delete my logs now.
If you're gonna do this, don't look at it, you know, online. And actually, it was interesting. I think we maybe talked about this a couple months ago, but the internet knows what you're gonna do, because like before I buy right. a car, yeah. I do all these searches on yeah. cars, and then I do more specific searches on a certain car, and then I do searches on loans and mm-hmm. rates and all that kind of stuff. And pretty much if the internet were smart enough, they could predict exactly when you were going to go to the movie, when you're going to buy a car,
yeah,
when you're
crazy.
Going to buy a home. Wow. Yeah, that's pretty scary if you think about it. It's yeah. like footprint of everything you're thinking about, because you're just typing it in all day long.
So maybe 18 to 24 months isn't good enough.
Right. Well, you're one step away from the one funny email. Are you sure you want to order that pizza? We've checked, and today you had this many calories. Are you yeah. sure?
We just had pizza.
That's pretty good. Deny or allow?
Yeah, deny or allow. Okay, so Jeff, what did you find on the, what was it, the Scoble post?
Yeah, actually, you know, in preparing for this, I figured I had one of two routes. I could come up with something and say something really good about Apple.
What do you say?
Just to let you know, I have listened. Or I could come up with something bashing Microsoft. So I went for the latter.
All right.
Having worked for the government for way too long in a Microsoft shop, basically Robert Scoble on his blog at scobalizer.com basically said Microsoft sucks.
Nice.
He accused them of not being able to compete. He accused them of not being innovative in any way, shape, or form. He basically called out Ballmer, who in one of his speeches basically said that Google hasn't really done anything. They've developed one product and everything else is pretty. Scoble goes on to criticize just about everything they've done lately, telling them to stop the talk, ship a better search, a better advertising system than Google, a better hosting service than Amazon, better anything, or just shut up, is basically what it came out to, which is really kind of ironic because Scoble basically owes his name to Microsoft. I mean, that's what he got famous for.
Right.
So, and what I really thought ironic was this story came off of the Times Online, and ironically at the bottom, after calling out Microsoft, the page itself is sponsored by Microsoft Live, which I thought was very,
nice.
Very unique. But again, it's followed by the 36 comments of how Microsoft is an evil entity and they don't deserve to. I don't know if I would quite go that far.
Yeah.
But they actually did have a quote in here from LiveSide, which is a website that tracks the development of Windows Live. And basically the quote is, Windows Live isn't making much of a dent in the marketplace. It's a non-topic. Market research shows live search to be losing share, certainly not gaining. And these are the advocates. These are the people that are hoping Microsoft succeeds.
Wow. Right.
So realistically, I can see Scoble taking the John Dvorak route, but it's still kind of the pot calling the kettle black at this stage.
True.
Right.
So I thought that was humorous and something good to share.
Interesting. Well, you know, if all else fails, you can always backstab the people whose shoulders you climbed on to get where you are. So
many people have succeeded doing exactly that.
And who deserves backstabbing more than Microsoft?
Well, and if you think about it, I mean, think about what Microsoft's most popular products are. And they've been around for a long time. And they really, I would say until Vista, whether you hate it or love it, haven't done anything amazing. I mean, and to change what their base product is, Office. You know, they finally have changed that with the new ribbon interface. It's like they're finally getting that, oh, maybe we do need to improve this product and not just add a couple features to get this.
Well, they can
sale.
Take risks because right. what are we going to
yeah,
do?
Yeah, exactly.
Not
and they
it.
Haven't been doing that.
We don't have any choice.
But that's exactly where they're coming from. They don't need to innovate because they're already in your pocket.
Yeah.
Whereas
yeah.
these small pop mom and pop shops can't compete. They don't have unlimited budget to be able to come out with anything.
I mean, I guess we are, you know, podcasters who make very little money telling Microsoft the most profitable company in the world.
Oh, I'd take their profits any day. I would never accuse them of bad business practices.
Yeah, I
I'm just talking
true.
About their software.
No, I agree. I agree with you 100%. So.
Yeah, so moving on. There was a study that was put out by the Journal of Experimental Psychology. They pulled in about 200 people, and they basically had them play racing simulation games. And then afterwards, they tried to measure whether or not this increased the likelihood of risky behavior in men and women. So it turns out that I think it was a little more in the men, but after playing...
What a shock,
right? So after playing like racing speed games like Need for Speed or something like that, Midnight Club, or that the men tended to take more risks both in actual traffic and in other behaviors, and also they had more thoughts of taking risks. So... You know, while I don't endorse the whole idea of, you know, violent video games make people violent, I think that there may be an element there of just raising someone's adrenaline. If you go to a LAN party and you're, you know, fragging left and right and, you know, you're all amped up on caffeine and, you know, you're doing great and suddenly you jump in your car and you head to 7-Eleven, you may be driving a little faster, you know, just based on, you know, your physiological state at that time.
I wonder what the correlation of that is to the type of music that's playing in these
games.
Yeah,
right. I was thinking the same thing.
Lots of factors there. Well, the other thing, too, is when I first read it, I thought, okay, well, you figure, oh, well, driving games make people drive faster. Well, maybe people that already drive fast like to buy racing games.
So. Good point. Miss Daisy doesn't want to buy, you know, Gran Turismo to putter along in the emergency lane.
But yeah. they did have a control group where they had them play other games that were like basketball or, you know, something. You know,
so Mario Kart doesn't make you want to jump off a cliff or anything.
I think so. I guess like playing The Sims or something like that doesn't make you want to, like, you know, try to beat that train at the train crossing. But yeah. I don't know.
I think your point of you know, just adrenaline. I mean, if you think about it, like whenever I leave like a really good concert, I'm driving faster. Mm-hmm. I'm cranking up the tunes. I'm driving faster. You know, if I have, you know, if I get in a fight with my wife, say, and
that would never happen.
and I'm driving a lot faster usually in that case. So, you know, is it truly because it's a racing game? I don't know if we can really ever prove that.
And on a side note, where do they do these studies? The only studies I ever hear about are they want to pump me full of pills and watch how I sleep for a week.
Sign
I want
me
to be
up
the one to
this.
Play the games.
Right.
Yeah.
Apparently it was at the Alliance Center for Technology.
That's where I'm going. Next week, I'm going. Study of first-person shooters on the male ego.
Right. I got you.
That's good. That's good. Well, another interesting story this week, and this one I find actually really fascinating, and it shows that Adobe is trying to innovate a little bit and keep up with the times. I'm seeing this more and more with their products, but they launched a new product called Apollo. And basically what it does is allow web applications to run for the desktop. Now, that sounds pretty simple at first. Well, aren't they already running on your desktop through a browser? The interesting thing is apparently you can pull out the plug, the network plug, and still run these apps. So one example they showed is an eBay app where you can add auctions, and you can pull out the network cable, you know, type in your new auctions you want to add, then the next time you plug in, it's going to sync with eBay and add those auctions for you. You know, I really see, I mean, web apps is where everything's going, so this really shows smarts on Adobe's part. I mean, this can't be something they just whipped up in the last couple of weeks. They have to have been thinking about this at least for a little bit. And I really am actually very impressed by this product. I haven't really seen it running. I don't know if it works well. It could be total junk.
Well, they just released it last night. So
yeah. Well,
the demo apps are kind of set up to be impressive.
Sure.
It really does mean a lot of things for the enterprise, though, especially from a business level. You know, most people who load up a website and it loads Flash, they stop right then.
Mm.
And where that's really going to take off now is within businesses.
Nice.
The ability to sync up on the fly, grab what you need, and work outside of the browser is going to take it a long way.
That's smart. Yeah, and so our guest, he's actually a web developer currently, manager currently, but web developer for several years.
We didn't have
right?
to bring that up. We didn't have to say that.
Yeah, but you know, it shows that you know a little bit more about this than maybe a couple sysadmins sitting around talking about nothing. So I'm curious what your thoughts are maybe on just where you think web apps are going, and do you think web apps are the future, or are we going to still be using desktop apps for most of our products?
You're never going to get away from desktop apps. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at what drives the business, you know, what drives the internet is the entertainment industry. What drives the business is the information.
Yeah.
And that's what you're going to... So you're never going to have PeopleSoft as a standalone web app. You're never going to have SAP as a standalone web app. But the interfaces for those, that gives you a lot of power. Instead of buying, you know, $3,000 clients for popular workflow tools,
right.
Being able to harness that and also gathering the data out of the back end, maybe not actually doing the work that application is designed to do, but using that data for other uses instead of just collecting it is a powerful tool. And something like this, which is built off of their Flex technology, is going to get you out of the tabular data, just row after row of data, give you some other ideas of how you can present it.
So the Flex product, can you kind of elaborate on that a little more? I don't think we've really talked about that on the show, and so if you could just kind of explain that a little bit for us.
Basically it's Adobe, well, previously Macromedia, and now Adobe,
right.
Pushing into the rich internet application space, basically harnessing the power of XML and ActionScript and Flash to provide a more compelling interface. One of the things that web apps have suffered from is the continuous click here to reload, click here to save, dump everything to Excel, those kind of things. Flex kind of gets you out of that, gives you the ability to start working in a much more, for lack of a better word, I am talking business here, much more of a Windows-type atmosphere.
Sure.
Makes it a little bit easier for the rank-and-file user to understand.
Nice. Yeah, so it sounds like they're really trying to break into the business side of things. I mean,
Adobe, they're one of the big companies going forward.
Yeah.
I think Adobe really is, after acquiring Macromedia and getting in line, I think that Microsoft and Google need to keep an eye on this company because one of them is going to bite.
Yeah, well, they're really utilizing those resources they bought. You know, people wondered, what were they going to do with this Macromedia purchase? Were they just going to roll Flash into Creative Suite, or were they actually going to do something powerful with it? And it looks like they really are moving forward.
Yeah, I believe so.
So have you guys heard about the Grand Central thing? This is the new software, the phone service, so that basically you sign up and you get one new number, and you give this to everybody you know, all your business associates, all your friends and family, and once they have this number, then it rings all of your phones at once. It rings your business phone, your cell phone, your home phone, and so wherever you happen to be, you just pick up the phone, and that's the end of it. Jeff, what do you think this is a good idea? Yes, no?
I think that's the most horrific thing I've ever heard. to tell you the truth, the idea of having one number that everybody can reach you on, that doesn't appeal to me whatsoever. I could understand having one number. I could even understand trying to find local numbers in some of my family's and other friends' area codes. I could see something like that being useful. Mm-hmm. But really, the idea that my boss dials one number and rings my BlackBerry and my home phone and my home cell and my son's cell and anywhere else to try to get a hold of me, that kind of frightens me.
Yeah, I kind of like the idea of being able to compartmentalize my data, how they get to me. So
You can turn off that pager, turn off that cell phone when you just don't want to hear from them anymore.
Exactly.
And it reeks of something that, you know, a debt collector or a telemarketer would just love to have, you know?
That's rough.
Hi, this is Bob, and I'd like to interest you and see if you're interested in buying the new blah. Bob.
And that's not what they do anymore, because the phone rings and you pick it up and they're like, "Hey, Jeff, how's it going, man?"
Oh, yeah.
And you're like,
thank God for the no call list.
Yes. Yeah, he's like, "Who is this?" "Oh, this is Jason." "Okay." "Yeah, I haven't talked to you in a while." "All right. Jason who?" "Jason Smith. I'm from American Telemarketing." I mean, they act like you're your friend and your long-lost relative.
That's where I blow the whistle directly into the phone. The thing that worries me is knowing that somehow, in some way, this is going to be connected to the internet.
Right.
And the first time someone leaves the door unlocked, the first time someone makes a mistake when they update their corny website, you've got one number reference to every piece of contact information you've given them.
Well, the article mentions The Lawnmower Man, the movie where like all the phones ring at the same time in the world.
So. My birth cry will be all the phones at once. That's lovely. Oh,
so it does do a couple of cool things, though. They said that you can check your messages from anywhere. So you can check your messages from online. You can check your message. You can like stream them. You can call in. You can get them via email.
Now, I think Vonage offers that same
probably
system.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
When someone calls, it like announces, like, "This is Jeff Graham calling from blah, blah, blah." And then you can choose to pick up the phone, yes, no. The other thing you can do is you can kind of screen your calls so that while someone's leaving you a voicemail, you can kind of listen in.
Oh, that's crazy.
That might be handy. I could see that might be handy.
Right. Yeah,
especially on the business phone.
So if you see the boss calling and you're like, "I'm going to let it take a message." And he's like, "Oh, Jeff, I was going to call you in to talk about your raise." And you suddenly pick up, like, "Oh, hey, I almost missed you. I was just in the can." You know, so
the likelihood of that is so very small.
So, yeah, maybe you could use, you know, don't use it for all your numbers, but say you have a work number and a work cell, use it for both of those and combine them into one.
Yeah, I could see where that would be helpful. Of course, now, most internal phone systems in a company of any size is going to give you the ability to do that.
Yeah.
I think this is a unique idea. I don't think it's more than a niche market.
Yeah, probably.
Right. Still an interesting idea.
Very much so.
So next thing we've got, Red Hat Enterprise Linux 5 came out this week. Mm. Now, yeah, sure, it's just another Red Hat release. Not that exciting. But a couple of things that are nice about this. They rolled in the new kernel, Linux kernel, that allows virtualization kind of built in. So Red Hat from now on will have built-in virtualization, which is a pretty hot topic right now, you know, being able to run virtualized servers or test out that new OS without installing it on a machine. You know, that's a lot of people are looking for that now, and so that's a nice thing. The other thing I thought that was interesting is it's not really part of the release, but it's a part of their, I guess, maintenance contract that you can get with them, is that they'll allow you to pay for support for third-party apps. Hmm. So say you want to use MySQL instead of whatever Red Hat offers, you can pay for that, and they'll give you support, which it's kind of Red Hat's market, is that, you know, we support really, really well. So if you want to pay for that, we'll support you.
Well, I mean, but to be fair, that's all they really sell, isn't it?
Right, exactly.
Just the support.
Yeah, so it's really pretty smart on their part to support something else that they didn't create.
Right.
Hey, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
But it's like you're saying, so Red Hat right now is basically just Fedora plus tech support.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or in our case, CentOS.
Yes, exactly.
Situations. Yeah.
So I mean, it's smart. It's a way for them to keep gaining market share. I mean, in the past, if you have MySQL, your only support is the forums. So this is a little better than that. It'll make it easier for companies to use some of those other niche market Linux apps. And, you know, then if you can tell your boss, hey, we've got support for it, then they'll be a little more likely.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, if you can subscribe to the $4,000 a year service plan, you're gold.
Yeah, and I forget how much it is if you just pay for, like, patching. I think it's a few hundred.
It's not cheap, but, you know, that's really what has made Red Hat popular is their peace of mind that it gives the boss, really. I mean, that's what you're paying for.
But, you know, how can you have peace of mind? Because there's Microsoft code in there.
That's right.
And we're
right.
all
going to
get sued.
They're getting
sued. Showusthecode.com.
Yeah.
So this week we're going to take a few minutes to talk to our guest, Jeff Graham, about some of the things he has seen in his experiences with IT management and some of the mistakes that are being made and possible solutions to those. So Jeff, if you want to, I guess give us a minute or so and just sort of tell us sort of your background and kind of where you're coming from, you know, back in history with what you're doing.
Okay, I used to walk uphill to school both ways in the snow.
Wow!
No, really, I came up in communications and networking. Spent several years doing that. Spent a couple of years doing straight system admin work, both in a Windows and a Joy of Joy Banyan Vines environment.
Wow, I haven't heard those words.
I just dated myself wonderfully. I love that. From there, moved on to the software side of things and pseudo software side of things, designing for the web and things like that. And just lately, I've sold out entirely.
So, in other words, you've become a manager.
Yes, guilty.
Okay. So, you've seen this from all sides and from all levels. So, where do you think most problems are coming from these days, and where do you think IT management is kind of going wrong out there in the world?
Well, I think number three would probably be the fact that we've devolved into a group of people that manage by committee. Basically, everyone's got their favorite pet tech, and that is the person who has got the right idea, and everyone should get on board and follow along.
Wow.
That's one of the big ones. The biggest one by far is we listen to the users entirely too much. If they knew what they were talking about, they wouldn't be calling us, and whether you're on the hardware side or the software side, that holds true.
Right, so the whole tip of the iceberg thing where the user only sees just the front end of it, but they don't have any visibility into how much work it takes to do the infrastructure, the back end, and all that kind of stuff.
So. Right. Well, I mean, they like to come in and give you the solution to their problem. And if they were in any way, shape, or form, you know, qualified to make that assessment, they would have just fixed it.
Right.
But they can't fix it. Well, you lock me out of the settings. I can't get to that. I don't know that language. Exactly. Shut up.
Right.
Step away, and we'll fix this for you. But don't dictate to us how we're going to fix it for you. I think that's probably the number one thing. Enough of the users now have read enough Dilbert strips. They've watched enough TV. They think they know how to speak these things. You know, 10 years ago, it was the guy who had AOL. He was the first guy at the house to have AOL. They made him the IT manager.
Right.
Now, they have progressed. 10 years later, they are not the IT managers. They are not the first line support. They are in charge.
When you come in during the day, do you think that the managers that you run into that are in IT, do they seem to you to be more the case of programmers or IT workers who rose through the ranks, or are they people who manage, like, who are just managers who got thrown in charge of managing IT people when they didn't know anything about IT? Which of those two do you run into more often?
Well, up until lately, it's been an even mix. I mean, there's always the middle managers who are professional managers. That's what they do.
Right.
They have lots of three-letter acronyms. They come after their name, PMP, and all those beautiful things.
Right.
The folks that have risen up through the ranks are usually what you would depend on to be the rock-solid guys, the guys that are going to go at it. But, you know, it is true. You're promoted to your highest level of incompetence, and I'm living proof of that. Several of the people that I deal with day to day have risen up through the ranks. Some of them, just like anything else, no different than the guys out in the field. Some of them really good at what they're doing. The others, not so much.
Right. Well, do you think Do you think it's true that the maybe the technical guys who get promoted up because of their time in, that maybe sometimes they don't have the people skills or the interpersonal managing skills to succeed?
I think that's certainly the case. And they're also hampered by the fact that because of the amount of time that they've had and the disconnect and the amount of time that they've actually been doing technical work is so great from the people that they're trying to manage, mm-hmm. that it's just, even if they do have good interpersonal skills, all they can really talk about is, hey, what'd you do this weekend? You know, hey, I'm moving. You want to come help me? Because they have no clue of what's going on in the trenches.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, what about managers who don't come from a technical background, who are just, like you say, professional managers? Do you think it's possible for a manager like that to successfully manage IT projects?
I think it's very, very possible. Some of the best managers I've ever worked for were never technical. Mm-hmm. Some of, you know, people who have the ability to point out the right people to get the job done, the ability to concisely say, here's what we need to do, mm-hmm. and then the ability to back away and get out of mm-hmm. those people's way to let yeah. them get done. And the people who are truly career managers, the people that are doing it because they love it, they can be highly effective in doing that. It's the ones that are doing it because they didn't succeed anywhere else
right.
that are the problem.
What about like micromanaging? Do you see that a lot? Is it a problem, you know, that in your experience?
In my recent experience, not so much. I have seen situations where management will be wrapped so tight that regardless of what the task is, they're always in the middle of it. And you know what, from certain, I mean, especially on the software side, very rarely is the manager on the software side even remotely knowledgeable in that area. Mm-hmm. So it hurts.
And so considering how long you've been doing this, and, you know, I think when you started, you know, working in the IT field, we had like Zeppelins and the bicycles with the big front tire and, you know, and fire was invented. Since you've started, do you feel like across the board IT workers are getting dumber or worse?
They're definitely getting more certified. certification's got to be the worst thing to ever happen in this industry. That I don't think anyone's become dumber. I think if anything, we appear dumber because the user base has gotten so much mm-hmm. more intelligent about what they're doing. You know, 15 years ago, no one had a clue. I mean, the cable box, the cable coax coming into their house was, you know, voodoo.
Right.
Nowadays, these people have HD rigs at home. They've got wireless networks in the house. Now, sure, Geek Squad installed it.
Right.
But I read the back of the box. I know mm-hmm. what this means. It's a G.
Right.
It's a what G? It's a G. Shut up. You know? they've come up a little bit. And plus, their kids are teaching them these things.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
sure.
the kids that had no clue 10 years ago are the people that are doing the first line support now. Mm-hmm. So they have a better understanding. So I wouldn't say we've gotten dumber. I would just say the user, as hard as this is to believe, has become a little bit more knowledgeable. I won't say smart, because mm-hmm. they're a little too right. emotionally involved to be
yeah.
smart, but
right.
they do have a better understanding.
Do you think that the users getting smarter maybe has actually led to some problems, and that they try to be more involved even though they don't completely understand it?
I think it has, but I don't think it's direct. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that the users, you know what, you don't get 300 calls a day anymore to say, hey, I can't get my email.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of those things have gone, and I think as a knee-jerk reaction, we in IT have actually gone out of our way to try to add more value
right.
to what
yeah.
we're doing.
Yeah.
And as a result, we're wrecking the enterprise. I mean, things that have been going on since the Industrial Revolution, moving piece of paper from point A to point B
right.
has now involved three different departments and, you know, four or five different mixes of technology. So I think if anything has hampered it, it's been us, because we're
yeah.
reacting to the user.
Good point.
Right. I think, too, is one thing I see are people, things are kind of starting to work. Like, printers are kind of starting to work, and, you know, TCP/IP and Ethernet and web, and it's all kind of coming together, and it's getting a little easier. So users now, unfortunately for people in support, they're trying to push, like, say, their Windows systems beyond, like, where it was meant to be. So they're trying to map all kinds of crazy drives, and they're trying to, you know, run their C++ GUI over here, but they're writing their header files to a different map drive, and
mm-hmm.
you know, the network.
Why is my computer so slow? I don't understand.
Right. So I see cases where people are, they see a button and they press it and they expect all these miraculous things to happen, when I'm trying to explain to them that they're pushing it beyond the limits of practicality.
Right. Well, I mean, ask a user what their subnet mask is. Ask anybody when the last time they even saw the word subnet mask was, and then sit a 12-year-old in front of Trump at Windsock and say, okay, smart guy, set this up. Right. It's gotten dumbed down, not from the point that it is dumb, but it's been commoditized. Mm-hmm. You know, it's real easy.
Right. So it is, everything is more packaged and it just seems to work.
Them kids and their newfangled toys.
Right. So as a developer, what do you think about all the news that was coming out maybe even a few years ago, and you hear less about it now, but outsource development overseas, and you know, if a kid is starting college right now, I mean, if some kid who's 18 says, I'm going to go to college and I'm going to learn to be a programmer, you know, would you say run away fast, or would you encourage
it? Not in a million years. I would encourage it. Outsourcing has been nominally successful. Offshoring has been a complete failure. You know, if you need someone to polish things up and write your tech manuals, they might struggle through it. However, because of the communication problems, because of the time problems, and quite frankly, because they're fresh outs that have never cut a piece of code before in their lives, you're spending so much time managing them.
Right.
That, and half the code still gets redone. There's a shortage in most of the I don't want to say universe, but it's getting close. Mm-hmm. I was actually reading the other day where the UK is already, they're predicting a glut in 5 years. They've already seen it, and their companies are already trying to structure to start attracting people in because they're just not getting any CS grads. Now, whether being a CS grad is helpful to you or not, that's up for question. I mean, quite frankly, they're going to take a 21-year-old and teach them C. Whether or not they're going to jump out. I mean, anybody, even who's not a developer these days, can look at the one ads and tell what's selling. Mm-hmm. .NET is what's selling.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's going to be a shortage, and I wouldn't try to persuade anybody from getting out of it.
Hmm. Right. Do you think, I guess one of the things that I read was that a lot of coders that are coming onto the job market really cannot write code. They're just like cutting and pasting off of stuff they find on the internet, and I guess this kind of goes back to what I was asking earlier about whether you think that people in the IT field are getting worse, that maybe they're coming out of college and they don't know their craft, or that...
I think that's always been the case. I mean, regardless of what kind of job it is, I mean, just working in a steel mill, there were a lot of guys that phoned it in. Mm. You know, I mean, now granted, much harder. but, you know, the guy who grabbed his lunchbox and never came back after lunch is really no different. I think there are a lot of people... I don't use the term, you know, diploma mill or anything like that, but I would say in a class of 50 computer scientists, there's probably 5 kids doing their homework, and you know, the rest of them are phoning it in. I actually sat and had a conversation about 2 months ago with a woman, and I was this is a good one. I was at work and I was enjoying a nice beverage. It was a beautiful day, and this lovely young lady comes over and starts chatting to me, and you know, being old and hideous, I decided I'd sit and talk to her. And she explained to me how she got her degree. And basically, she was going to what she termed geek websites and submitting her homework, and these geeks who enjoy that would answer her questions. So she had a CS degree from a state school, and she did not know JavaScript. So I would say it is a problem, but it's the same problem you're always going to have. There's always going to be people shortchanging it.
So she got an A in MySpace, though.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, she's a little bit older than that, but I'm not quite the MySpace crowd anymore.
Wow. But one of the criticisms I had read about offshoring, you know, programming and things like that, maybe web design, was that I guess because of the culture difference, that the culture is so specific about what we expect, and when we bring up a website, you know, where's the menu, where's the layout, you know, the barriers to entry and things like that, that people from another culture just don't get it. Like maybe the site is functional, but it looks horrible, and maybe they just don't get the design you're trying to get.
Right. Well, it's like, but I mean, it's really, it's like comparing a Ferrari to a Ford. You know, the Ferrari is expensive. Now go back, you know, a long while back, and it's not just the name. It was a handcrafted car. And then compare it to the Ford that was put on an assembly line. When you send your code overseas, it's exactly what you're paying for. You're paying for an assembly line. They're going to follow the rigid instructions where they can.
Right.
Culture is also a big thing. Like you said, I had a coworker who was with a major cell phone company, and they outsourced all of their website, and she managed the project. And I forget where it was something that ended with poor, I think, Kuala Lumpur or something along those lines. And she would call up and say, here's what I need. And they would go, that's great. Put the boss on. Well, I am the boss. Well, you can't be the boss. You're a girl. Wow. So, I mean, all sorts of cultures cut into that problem.
Right, right, right. What about as a manager, do you, is your staff pretty easy to manage? Do you have...
Oh, that's really... Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, so what was that question again?
So let's maybe not be that specific.
Robert's going to listen to this, right?
Yeah, so among your coworkers, do you feel like taken as a whole, do you feel like your IT team, and I don't mean just the people maybe around your desk or on your floor, but as far as your entire internal IT organization, would you say as a whole they work together well, or they're very insular and they just do their little slice of the pie and they don't care what anyone else is working on? Do they have situational awareness?
For the most part, the majority of them do, but just like a lot of the IT organizations, we have so many things coming at us so fast that certain lines of demarcation crop up. Mm-hmm. You know, no one's walking around with a t-shirt that says, don't blame me, it's a software problem.
Right.
But those kind of things do happen. I mean, when you get right down to it, sometimes it's somebody's fault. And rather than beat around the bush and play huggy-feely games, when you're trying to crank out a serious workload, feelings get hurt. Sometimes the lines get blurred. Sometimes they don't. For the most part, the people on the ground doing the work are fairly good about teaming up and doing what needs to be done. But as always, with a diverse skill set, diverse backgrounds, sometimes there's wide gaping holes.
Right. Okay, so the last questions I'll throw at you is, do you think, which is harder, the people or the tech?
People, without a doubt. Everybody's special in their mama's eyes. Everyone is a unique snowflake. Everyone just needs that one afternoon off. What's the big deal? Right. In my experience, I was not prepared for it. I knew that people would be demanding of time. Mm-hmm. I never realized what kind of Degrassi middle school BS that I would have to put up with on a daily basis. But right. Definitely, I'll take the tech any day.
Right. Okay. That's cool. Well, Jeff, we appreciate you coming out to talk to us.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm glad that you could share your experiences from all of the different points of view that you've had throughout the years.
It's a pleasure.
All right, folks, that's going to wrap up episode 20 for Angry Admins. As always, feel free to check out our site at angryadmins.com. We'll post messages on the forums. If we have any follow-up information, we'll have links in the show notes to all the good stuff we talked about today. And if you want to, you can download the show on iTunes or stream it directly from the site. Until next week, I am Ryan Necessary.
And I'm Joe Bibby.
And I was Jeff Graham.
Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Stay angry.